Perfect. So I'm Benjamin Mako Hill, and I'm, I guess, I'm from MIT. I'm both a sort of fellow at the MIT Center for Future Civic Media, and I'm also relevant to the work that I'll be showing here. I'm on the board of directors of the Free Software Foundation, and sort of have a long history as a sort of advocate for free and open source software. And also that's sort of an academic interest in that that's what I'm sort of studying, both at the Center for Future Civic Media and at the Business School at MIT, where I'm working with some people who are looking at free and open source software. So, in any case, this is a talk sort of called Revealing Errors, and it's about a project that I've been doing for, I guess, probably about a year now, where I'm sort of exploring errors and trying to talk about errors as a way of sort of advocating for free and open source software. And I'll sort of explain how I think that that's useful, and why I think that errors are a useful way to start thinking about technology and about talking about technology to people, especially to sort of non-technologists or people who aren't as interested in it. So, in any case, I guess the first thing to say, which is sort of most important, is that I'm one of those sometimes, in some context, sort of annoying people who likes to talk about free software instead of open source, because I like to talk about freedom. So I guess I can sort of, in that sense, I believe that sort of free and open source software are based around a set of freedoms, rights, and sort of abilities of that users of software should be able to do, right? Unrestricted use, the ability to sort of study, modify, distribute, and collaborate on software, right? These are things that I think are good. These are sort of ideas that are shared within the free and open source software movements and groups. And of course, both the Free Software Foundation and the Open Source Initiative and a lot of other projects are about sort of spreading this message, right? Getting lots of people to be interested in using the software, because control over our technology is sort of a good idea. Now, our dark secret is that our organizations, right, the FSF, the organization that I'm involved with, but also the Open Source Initiative, or for that matter, the EFF, which is not really exactly in this space, but is talking about issues of sort of empowerment around technology, or sort of freedom in technology, right? I mean, I guess ideas that a lot of people here in the Berkman Center is also interested in. For the most part, communicating to these things to either non-technologists or sort of social scientists or scholars of technology ends up being really difficult. Despite the fact that the whole goal of free and open source software is about sort of empowering users of technology, for the most part, the movements are very poor at, you know, communicating anything to most users of technology, right? It's the developers who, I mean, in a sense, have absolutely everything to lose. They're the ones who have sort of development methodologies, and, you know, they work for companies and are going to have to find new ways of sort of making money in some cases. I mean, these are the people that are excited about it, if anyone's excited about it. And users of technology, who are the center of the message, are sort of not being communicated to at all. It's all developers, right? The membership of the FSF, the membership of the EFF is, for the most part, all technologists. And the message just doesn't sort of resonate beyond. So this is something that, as sort of as someone who's involved with some of these organizations, has thought about a lot, because I'm interested in sort of spreading this message more broadly. I mean, in part because I would like to sort of grow the membership of the Free Software Foundation, but also because I'd like to sort of help spread the message to the people to whom it's sort of pointed to. And I've come to a set of questions. The first is that while we're talking about user empowerment, right, in theory, in reality, the sort of free and open source software movement talks about software, right? We talk about the software needs to be this way or this piece of software, right? What we don't talk about is sort of empowerment and freedom and autonomy in a sort of more general term. So here's sort of the way that I understand. Here's the way that I understand it. As a designer of technology, I understand that technology is very powerful. Technology has certain affordances. It allows people to work in certain ways or not to work in other ways. I mean, I've got I got a new phone today, right? And it allows me to communicate in some ways that are different than my old phone, right? If I wanted to call up my, if I wanted to call up my partner, and you know, I see a beautiful sunset, and I want to, you know, say, oh wow, I saw this beautiful sunset using my own old phone. I can sort of, I don't know, describe it in words. I can maybe, I guess, write a text message. Maybe I could even write a poem which conveys some sort of deep meaning about it. But the point is that my ability to communicate is going to be restricted by my choice of technology, right? By the fact of that technology. This phone happens to have, I'm not sure how to use it exactly yet, but it has a camera, and presumably it has a way to send pictures taken with this camera as well. My ability to communicate the same event is going to be fundamentally different, right? Maybe richer, maybe in some ways less rich than the poem. I mean, I guess presumably I can still send the poem on this. The point is that in this case, there were no decisions by the technology provider to sort of disempower me or empower me, but I am by the fact of that technology empowered to communicate in different ways. And this is a much more fundamental point, which is that insofar as our lives are sort of mediated by technology, insofar as our experience, we experience the world through different technologies, communication technologies, right? Our ability to experience or ability to communicate, right, is defined quite explicitly by the technologies that we use and by the design, by extension, by the designers of the those technologies. That our ability, you know, what I can say, who I can say it to, right, how I can say it, when I can say it, is, you know, defined quite explicitly by the sort of affordances of the technology that I use and by the values of the designer. Who made it do certain things and not do other things, right? Whether they're trying to, you know, explicitly restrict me or not. And so the free and open source software message in this way can be thought of as just sort of an answer to this, to a question which is prompted by that, which is who gets to control that technology insofar as who gets to control one's experience. And insofar as we experience the world through technology, the ability to control it is a very important sort of question. So that's sort of where I'm starting from. That's the sort of idea. That's not the way that the story of free and open source software is usually sort of described, but it's the one that sort of motivates me. So to understand this message, right, you need to, you know, which I think is the implicit message, you know, behind work of groups like the EFF and the FSF and for that matter, a lot of work from, you know, people here is this idea that technology is powerful stuff, right? And of course, this message resonates with technology producers because they understand that they're powerful because they have that power, right? Because they do it. And people who study it know it because it's their job, right? If they don't know it, they're not, if the scholars of technology don't realize it, well, then they're not doing their job. And so we know that, right? Because we either build and design technologies, sort of implement technologies, or because we made it our job to understand it. But most users don't understand technology because they don't understand it's powerful. But I think that as I've sort of thought about this and tried to, you know, gone out into the world and sort of communicate this, I sort of came to the conclusion that things were actually even worse than that. That in my effort to sort of educate people about the power of technology, there's a bigger problem, which is that most people don't even realize that technologies, or at least most technologies, exist. So that I think that statement needs a little more defense. So here's a nice, if I can find out how to, here we go. Here's a nice quote from Mark Wiesner, who was sort of director of the Xerox PARC computer science program for a while, and he's also sort of founder of Ubiquitous Computing, this sort of UbiComp. And he says, a good tool is an invisible tool. By invisible, I mean the tool does not intrude on your consciousness. You focus on the task, not the tool. Eyeglasses are a good tool. You look at the world, not the eyeglasses. I mean, like, in this next paragraph, he sort of goes on in this paper where he's writing this and talks about how Vim is a great example of a good tool because it's just like eyeglasses, you know, or VI, like using the editor. I mean, like, seriously. So that was kind of funny. But I think his point is right on. That most technology is invisible to most people. And as sort of an advocate of free and open source software, I can't count the number of times I've had to say, you know, what are you working on? Oh, I work on, my projects are sort of the Debian project and the Ubuntu project. Say I work on these operating systems, free options. What's an operating system, right? Or it's very important that we have free firmware for wireless cards. What the hell is firmware? right? People, you know, if that's the way the conversation starts, it doesn't end up, it doesn't always end up very well. To sort of explain to someone, that, to have to explain what the technology is so that you can explain that it's powerful, so that you can explain that people should care about, you know, power over technology is a difficult sort of problem. So, and it's a big problem for you dumpster of software. The good news is that you know, technology is far from perfect, right? That you know, even a pair of eyeglasses. I mean, these eyeglasses are in quite bad shape, but a smudge on a pair of eyeglasses makes those glasses pretty visible, right? A crack, and you sure know cleaning your glasses. Now would be
thank
a,
you for reminding
yeah.
me.
So in that sense, errors, right? You know, the smudges on the eyeglasses, it can be sort of thought of as like the tip of an iceberg, right? They're the point in which the technology around us can be sort of thrust into view, and in the process, there are opportunities for advocates for sort of control, you know, user or control of technology. There are opportunities to explain why that technology is important and why one might want to have control over it. So, you know, I think I can throw that out there, but I think the best way to sort of understand this is to look at some examples of this. So I've got a small set of examples here, and if there's time, I'll show more, because I think that's the sort of fun part. So in any case, here is an ATM with a blue screen of death on it. So I mean, here's seen like, I mean, some people, I mean, I've seen a couple of these. Have you seen like a crashed ATM? He's like in these poor sort of states, right? Do you take a picture of it? I mean, I don't know. Anyone? So lots of people do, right? Like maybe people here don't, but like you can go on to, you know, Flickr or one of these websites full of pictures, and it's just like full of them. There's like hundreds of these pictures of these poor ATMs, right, in this sad state. Here's another one. This one says, "This copy of Windows must be activated before you can log on. Do you want to activate Windows now? If, in case there's any ambiguity, here's one just sort of booting up, right?" You know, as I said, lots of people take sort of pictures of these, and the reason is because, and you can see, because when people take pictures, sometimes they leave little comments or they post a picture on their blog and they sort of describe it, right? They say things something along the lines of, like, "My bank is running Windows, right? My ATM is running Windows. Oh my God!" You know, like, and of course, this is sort of like immediately followed up by, like, you know, "I'm trusting my money to Microsoft Windows," right? I mean, these are people who, these are not free software advocates, right? These are people who run Windows every day and have in all likelihood lost data from a crash or, you know, who knows what in the last year or so, right? They have problems with viruses, they have problems with all sorts of stuff, and they have a very sort of real concern, you know, that this thing isn't going to work. And so they're thinking, should I trust my money to something running Windows, right? And this is not, I mean, I'm not making this up. You can find exactly this sort of thought process made very explicit by lots of people who are not sort of technologists who sort of see this and all of a sudden sort of wonder about this. Now, the point here, of course, is that it's not like Windows is bad; it shouldn't be run on ATMs, right? The point is that you know, these ATMs were always running Windows, right? It's not like this is a new thing, right? People have gone to these ATMs every day and use them perfectly fine, and they never thought, for the most part. Maybe even those of us that do think about technology have never thought. You know what? That ATM probably running an operating system, and maybe they've taken steps to prevent it from viruses. But the reality is that a large portion of the ATMs that we're using absolutely are susceptible to normal viruses that your computer can get, right? They're running the same operating system. They're connected to normal sort of, you know, to computer networks, which if not, you know, the internet, are certainly connected to computers that are connected to the internet. And the question of and these are sort of important questions. Yes, the choice of software that manages your money matters insofar as it might make a difference to the way that your money is treated, because it is handling your money. It's an important question, and it's a question presumably the people at the bank have thought long and hard about and concluded that yes, in fact, it's very safe that it runs Windows, right? But the point is that this is exactly, this is a very important type of thought process. And it's something that for the most people, people don't do, but because they never think that it's running an operating system. When they see their poor ATM, you know, with the blue screen of death, all of a sudden the air, you know, sets up exactly the kind of conversation about sort of technological choices, about the impact on the users, and ultimately provides a real opportunity to talk about whether or not that was the right choice and whether or not people should be doing things differently. It's also worth pointing out that in some places in the world, including Brazil, there are ATMs which run Linux actually display the little penguin on the ATM, like when it's not crashed, like normally, as a way of saying, you know, you should trust this because in fact we've made particular sort of decisions, right? So it's sort of actually exposing technological decisions in a very explicit way. So that's a...
What's really funny that in Brazil it's more important than here, where people are much more literate in software.
Uh-huh.
That's what's really funny.
So, so I'll show one more of these because I think they're funny. This one says, welcome to the found new hardware wizard. So this is a, you know, the person who installed the card skimmer on this Windows ATM forgot to install the device driver for it or something like that. All right, so I'll give a couple more sort of concrete examples and then maybe I'll show more if there's time. So this one is, let's see. Oh wait, oh, this is, there's sound on this. Should I, can I plug that in? Is that possible?
Yeah,
let's do it. Okay. Cool. Okay, so, cool.
Ah, Vivian, I've been wondering about some of the four-letter words we offer.
Have you indeed?
For example, if I type in... I get ship. I get ship. That a word people use? Of course, ship. I can provide a knife-like weapon, as in I just match the blackguard with my ship. The second choice we offer is... as in the abbreviation for the gene phosphatidylinositoglycan class T. Mm-hmm. And those, I believe, are all the suggestions we offer. What about shit? Huh? It's a silly word for feces and backstitching anything or anyone of poor quality.
Yes, I know the term only too well.
Good. Are you seriously suggesting that the sort of people who compose predictive text messages on their mobile phones would ever use a word like shit? I was talking to the milkman this morning, and he said it's in quite common usage. So when someone types this, isn't it more likely they're trying to write shit than shiv or kicked? Our job,
Gilbert,
is to offer people not the words they do use, but the words that they should use, so you always say. Which is why when someone types in... I think predictive text can be a real force for good. Turning rude messages into polite messages, such as sips off your ducking yanker. Nothing less than this. An entire generation of youngsters with manners, courtesy, and a weirdly extensive vocabulary. Words won't just disappear. And besides, if someone really wants to make, let's say, bad chocolate, switch into non-predictive mode and spell it letter by letter. You're a talented boy, Gilbert, and I know you mean well, but sometimes you really are a total aunt. You've got a pool. You did not touch the pool, my friend. You were nowhere near the pool. That is total bullshit.
All right. I thought that was cute. It's a nice example of something that of a type of error we see in lots of places, right? So I guess a variant of the same sort of thing comes with every sort of spell checker. Every time you spell checker, you get, you know, like how many times you spell the word, you know, shit, and it's like, oh, this word's misspelled. Right? I mean, like, it's an actual word, right? Like, as much as we might not like it, or as much as some people might not like it, it is in fact an English word. It was, in fact, in the word list that people used to compile the dictionaries, because we know which word list people, where people went. You know, Microsoft used the Funken Reiter dictionary, which they bought, and they removed words that they, you know, the sort of profanity, right? Not because anyone would see them, of course, this is a spell checker, right? But because they wanted people to sort of take personal responsibility to say, you know, ignore, or if you're like a bad enough person to add it to your personal word list, right? Sort of like very explicitly sort of take personal responsibility for this sort of thing. So it is an error, right? In these are words, but it's also very much an intentional error in this. It's the kind of thing that reveals the fact that, you know, it's an aspect of the technology that very explicitly makes it easier to say certain things than it does to say certain other things, right? In the same way that it's easier to say, if you're using predictive text, it's easier to write sort of full sentences. Or use words that are going to be in the dictionary just as a sort of form of speech. You can tell in some cases what people are using based on the way that what technology people are using to communicate by the type of the technology. But the place where it becomes really visible in places like errors, right? Because no one's going to accidentally type, you know, pigged when they mean to type shit, right? But if it shows up, it's an error that sort of reveals the technology. And every time anyone tries to type in and they get pointed to this, that they see that very sort of explicitly. Here's another example that before I say too much more about that, I'll show another example, which is kind of cool. Homosexual eases into the 100 final at the Olympic at the Olympic trials. This is from One News Now. So this is, of course, not about a homosexual who got into the 100 final at the Olympic trials. This is about Tyson Gay, who got into the 100 final at the Olympic trials. This is from a website called One News Now, which is actually a news site run by the American Family Association, which is a sort of right-wing Christian organization. And so American Family Association prefers certain words to others, and happens to run a version of the AP sort of headline, the AP news, where they basically just take in an AP feed. Apparently apply a set of regular expressions to these, where they swap certain words for other words, and then republish it sort of automatically, right? No human is injured through this process, except the ones reading it, maybe. And one of the things they do is they change every instance of the word gay to homosexual, because homosexual sounds, you know, clinical, almost pathological, right? Whereas gay sounds like, you know, could almost be happy, you know, could almost be someone might want to be gay, right? Or for whatever reason, they decided that this term and a series of other ones, that they made certain word choices, and they run a set of regular expressions, and they run them on the site, and they publish the feed, right? So no one knew they were doing this. The people who read the site didn't know that they were doing this. They never published this, right? They had a sort of black box that was making a set of very explicit decisions about the way that technology was about the was, you know, changing the message that was being produced, but also and affecting the way that it was understood by their viewers. And people didn't know until it didn't work, and then it became pretty clear, right? I mean, like, there's no way someone might misspell Tyson Gay's last name as homosexual, right? It becomes pretty clear what's going on, and if it was ambiguous, they made it pretty clear by publishing lots and lots of other articles where they talk about homosexuals winning sprints. And there's a series of other things as well. So there's a whole class of these sorts of errors as well. There's a very famous one where people will try to change in sort of like forums and stuff. They'll change any instance of sort of profanity there by using a similar thing where they just change, you know, ass to butt, for example. That's a famous one. And there's been a few examples where people sort of screwed up and they didn't look for the spaces next, but they actually just changed every instance of ass to butt throughout the whole thing. So you end up with clubuttic instead of classic is the famous one. And you can even find a couple references on the web to the attempted buttonation of Ronald Reagan. Whole sets of different things, right? And it's not hard to sort of figure out exactly what was going on in most of those situations. I like I like these because it's an example of a script that had been running for well over a year, right? And that the people reading it didn't realize it was going on there. It was changing the message, and it was sort of changing the way that people experience the world. And they didn't know this technology. I mean, in this case, because, I mean, it's not clear that they were intentionally trying to hide it, right? I mean, presumably the people on the readers of the One News Now, you know, are going to likely to, you know, the sort of people who will agree with the American Families Association on terminology, right? But it's an important sort of way that some of these things sort of get made visible. Oh, you know, how much? What's the time? Should I think about?
Well, you can give a few more examples, I think.
Okay. Okay, let me give a couple more examples then. Oh, there it is. Let's see. Let me open. I have another one where I have a whole bunch more examples. So, let's see. Mako talks. Let's see. And then there was another Revealing Airs talk that was good. And then this one should have a bunch. Let's see what's here. That's the same one. No. Let's see. I was looking at one earlier that was pretty good. It doesn't like this one. This is the same one. Let's.
So I have a question for you.
Yeah, go ahead.
So you're saying, or you're looking at errors as a way of showing users the kind of power they could potentially have.
Uh-huh. Oh, here it is. Oh, they were opening. They were just opening on this laptop over here. Okay. Sorry about that. All right. Let's see. There's a bunch of more errors here. So yeah, go ahead. Keep going.
So I was wondering what you think of the work that Ed Felton has done, the professor at Princeton, who has documented extensively the kind of, I guess, intentional errors are in the Diebold folding machines.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if this is true or not, but I sense that there has not been the kind of outrage about these errors that should have come. I mean, like, you know, to find out that Windows is running, you know, your banking machine is one thing, to like find out that voting machines have these latent errors to them.
So, I mean, what I like about sort of work on voting machines and voting machine errors is that it's already a very sort of politicized technology. I mean, you can't get more politicized than a voting machine, right? It's sort of like an instrument of politics, and so in that extent, people, it's easy to understand why sort of, and the reason you can get lots and lots of people upset about this is because they understand that there's sort of a politics to voting machines, and that's useful. And sure, errors sometimes can reveal, problems with that. But the point is that I think that there's an understanding that there's a real political effect for election technology from the very beginning, and that's why it's a useful place to start a conversation, right? Part of what I'm trying to show is that all technology that you're sort of, you know, there's a politics to all technology. Now it may not be as sort of directly, you know, I mean, some technology is more important than others, right? Insofar as, and some technology might be more important to control, insofar as it has more control over our sort of our own sort of experience. That seems absolutely possible. But technologies that we use, I mean, some really fundamental ones, asking what it means to have control over that technology can be sort of really explicit. What I liked about the examples that I showed, those examples, and the reason I picked those out, I mean, I've done, I don't know, dozens and dozens of errors, which I've sort of unpacked and on revealingerrors.com, I'll sort of say, here's an error, here's what it reveals, and then here's why it might be important. Here's, you know, the sort of power structures that, or sort of issues of power over technology that we might want to think about, right? That this sort of reveals. I sort of walk through that process over and over. It's more like a methodology, right? A way of looking at these things. What I like about those ones is not that I think that they're particularly important, right? The spell checker thing. It's easy enough to get around. It's a little bit annoying. What I like about, and it's not clear that anyone actually reads One News Now anyway. It's a cheap thing for them to do. They sort of buy a feed. The reason I like those examples is because they make very explicit the values of the designer in the project, right? I mean, like, it's quite explicit. I prefer the term, you know, I don't, not me, but One News Now prefers the term homosexual to gay for explicit sort of political reasons. And it's not just their technology that's exposed. It's their politics. And the connection is very explicit in that way as well, in a way that's very similar to voting machines. So I'd like to explore the way that we can look at technological sort of analysis of voting machines and actually sort of connect it to a broader sort of discourse around control over technology more generally. Yes, our political decisions are not only framed and influenced by the technologies we use to actually make the vote. They're framed by the media we use, for example, to gather the information that we then use to decide exactly which buttons we're going to press on that voting machine, right? And we don't seem to hold any of that media technology, or at least very few of us, right? Richard Stallman and a couple other people. But most of us don't seem to want to hold that communication technology to the same standard that we want to hold our voting machines for, right? I mean, most people don't even want to hold the voting machines to that standard, so I guess that's not. The point is that our sort of experience and our political process happens in a much sort of broader technological area, and control over that technology more broadly seems like something that we should at least be thinking about.
Shall we turn to the audience for some more questions? Or more questions, comments?
I got one. The whole point of this project is talking to regular people and showing them, you know, the power of technology and such. And really, you may be familiar with the program. It's NPR on WNYC. It's called Radiolab. There's an episode, and it's basically kind of science to non-science types. And so the episode you might want to check out is called Tell Me a Story, mm-hmm. and it's basically the whole philosophy of the program, and it's about why you should be talking to, average Joes and such about science. And the way they do it with concrete examples and stuff like that, and telling a story, I think that's what you're trying to do here. So it may be something you just want to take a look at as, you know, see how they do it as a way to... get it out there.
There are a couple of reasons why I like AIRS. One is that I think that it actually does this. It has this sort of tip of the iceberg sort of thing, and that it can sort of provide a window into a much larger technical system. But the other reason is that AIRS are funny. The people sort of like seeing the blue screen of death projected onto the top of the stadium in the Olympics during the opening ceremony, right? People just sort of like, ha ha. A little bit of a sort of, I don't know.
It's the same kind of humor if someone hurts it himself.
Yeah, that's right. Microsoft has billions of dollars. None of us ever will, so we like the idea that they can be sort of caught with their pants down lots of places. The point is that there are lots of, every couple of years someone publishes a book on AIRS, right? It doesn't say much other than just, it's like, look at all these funny AIRS, right? There's a bunch of blogs. The biggest one is probably FailBlog now. But there's millions of people who see this, right? Just because they like watching pictures of, like signs that are misprinted in humorous ways, or people running into, poles or whatever, right? That there's a particular attraction with just AIRS. So it's a in that sense, it's an opportunity to tell a story that people might want to hear anyway, right? And in the process, also sort of connect it to what I think is a more important sort of conversation, or maybe just make learning about technology slightly palatable.
Do you find that showing AIRS actually makes people sort of not understand technology more? I mean, usually when I hear non-technical people talking about AIRS, it's more of a, like, the implicit message is technology is bad, we shouldn't trust it, we shouldn't rely on it. And they sort of stop there. They don't sort of say, well, we could make more reliable technologies, we could make technologies in a way we wouldn't rely on. They're just like, just the general pie in the sky technology is bad, but we can't do anything about it type of thing.
I like people being critical about technology, right? saying, oh, this is complicated and there are all sorts of things. I mean, you know, and then there are lots of questions about it. I mean, I think that that's better than saying, oh, yeah, it just sort of works, you know, or better than saying, you know, the ATM is the machine I put the card into when money comes out, or email is, you know, I go to gmail.com and I type things and I press send, right? There's a huge amount of infrastructure, you know, that makes that work, right? And that huge amount of infrastructure makes certain people very powerful, right? Have control over you and your life in some very important ways. And we can't have that conversation unless we point out that there is something going on back here. This is an example from Facebook source code. They had an error in Facebook that actually exposed their source code. They've in fact since contributed a piece of sort of free and open source software to the Apache project, which is the source protection plugin, which keeps you from accidentally distributing your source code because they've done it twice. This didn't get a lot of press, but this is a code, this is from the Facebook source code. It says, put baddies, hotties in here. That's an array of unique user identifiers, right? People who they think are, I don't know, bad or hot that they want to track, and they've written code specifically to do it. Or there's another, monitoring these people's profile viewage, stored in central DB on profile views, helpful for law enforcement to monitor stalkers and stalkies, right? This has been going on this was certainly going on when the code was released. We have no reason to believe it stopped. We have every reason to believe that it's only increased in scope insofar as the site itself has increased in scope. These are reasonably sort of benign compared to what people, you know, what our technology designers can do. But we don't get to, you know, we don't get to talk about it, and the users of the system don't get to talk about it. And it's only when it screws up that we even get that view. And so by collecting, you know, little errors like this and talking about that, we can actually talk about that power. So, yeah.
So I was late, so I don't know if you talked about it, but it sounded to me like most of the things you talked about since I came in is just the tip of the iceberg and expression of political correctness of the country and technology. It's not the technology sort of, in a sense, could be blamed for it, but it's a political correctness that makes it change gay to homosexual.
That's about the value. So, I mean, I guess I'm still doing with the project is, as I sort of collect these things, I'm building sort of an ontology of revealing errors, right? Errors can reveal lots of things. One of the things they can reveal is the sort of values, right, or the politics of the person who's doing it. So I mean, I think that those are particularly powerful. That's why I've sort of put them in there. Another one, and these are sort of overlapping, is it could reveal, say, the particular affordances in a technology, right? Certain technologies are able to communicate certain things more easily than others, right? And sometimes, you know, when we try to communicate something and we in fact communicate something else, we see that, right? There's these the back to those predictive text input things. There's a great the example, the meet of after dinner, right? Me. If you type me on a phone, of, in fact, is the same mapping of numbers on your mobile phone, but it's apparently more common in whichever word list they've used, so you can send messages like meet of after dinner, right? That's a very explicit sort of way in which an affordance of a technology makes it easier to communicate one message than another, right? I mean, this isn't connected to the same sort of political, sort of explicitly political values, right? But there is a political effect of the nature of that control.
I'm not talking about political values when I'm talking about political correctness, because political values presumes one camp against the other, while political correctness covers majority of the country.
I don't think that changing changing gay to homosexual. That's done by a fringe organization.
I think most of the
they're taking this from the Associated Press, right? Which is mainstream. And they're changing it because they're a extreme right wing Christian organization, and are not happy with the sort of biased feeds that the AP is putting. They're not trying to be politically correct in this way. They're trying to match their own reasonably extreme politics.
So maybe that's not a good example, but in general, when you're talking about the dictionaries that don't allow for the word ass or shit or whatever else, that's political correctness. That has nothing to do, political on one side or another. That's a political correctness that is coming to the entire society.
I guess I just don't buy that politics, political correctness itself, the concept of political correctness, what it used to be, I mean, the term used to mean something that was good, you know, like 20 years ago. Now people only use the term politically correct when they're trying to disparage something for the most part, right? I mean, the term itself and the concept has changed a lot, and I think that it's kind of on the losing end right now, so I'm not sure. I think that it is a type of politics. It refers to a type of politics. That politics can win and lose. It can do better or worse. It might be more or less dominant in particular times. I mean, I still think it's a type of politics. So, yeah.
So, I don't know. I think we have to kind of round up.
People should.
One thing that we forgot to do is actually introduce ourselves. Sorry about that. So we'll make a short round, and then we'll move to...
Everyone should check out the blog. And when you see errors that are good, you should mail me. That's the last thing I'll say. Cool.